reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew. The Pharisees went off and plotted how they might entrap Jesus in his speech. They sent their disciples to him with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are a truthful man, that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth, and you're not concerned with anybody's opinion, for you do not regard a person's status. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" Knowing their malice, Jesus said, "Why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin that pays the census tax." Then they handed him the Roman coin. He said to them, "Whose image is this and whose inscription?" They replied, "Caesar's." At that he said to them, "Then repay to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, and to God what belongs to God." The Gospel of the Lord. In today's Gospel, two groups that were arch enemies conspired to try to trap Jesus. Both the Herodians and the Pharisees were trying to get Jesus out of the way because both felt threatened by him. They decided to ask him a question about which they themselves were constantly in disagreement, whether it was lawful to pay the census tax to or support in any way the Roman Empire. The Herodians were lax as brown nosers, and regardless of how they personally felt about a foreign power's ruling over them, decided that if you couldn't beat the Romans, you'd join them. They cooperated with the Romans in almost everything, including taxes. The Pharisees, on the other hand, like most of the Jews, deeply resented being dominated by a pagan power and found utterly repulsive the thought of giving tribute to a foreign ruler who fancied himself a god. Both groups thought that their long-standing disagreement was a perfect catch-22 by which to nail the carpenter from Nazareth. So they approached Jesus and manifested their mendacity and hypocrisy by a barrage of empty flattery. "Teacher, we know that you're a truthful man. You teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You show deference to no one. You don't play favorites." Then came the question, "Is it lawful to pay the census tax to Caesar or not?" It was the perfect query, they thought, because no matter how Jesus answered it, they had him. If he failed to respond, he would lose authority by ducking one of the most relevant political questions of the day. If he said yes, he would risk losing the affection of the masses who hated the Romans, hated the emperor, and particularly hated being forced to give him any recognition of all. And if he said no, then they could turn him over to Pontius Pilate for inciting lawlessness among the people. But Jesus couldn't be trapped, and he always brings good out of evil. In answer to their hypocrisy, Jesus pointed the path to human integrity. In response to their lying, Jesus gave us a truth to live by, one that's as relevant today as it ever was. After he'd asked to see a coin used for the tax, and they brought him one, showing basically that all of them used Roman money when it served their purposes, he queried, "Whose image is this and whose inscription?" When they responded, "Caesar's," he gave them and us a principle that extends far beyond the glory days of Rome. "Then give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God." Most of Jesus' original listeners thought that you couldn't serve two masters, both God and Caesar. Either you gave to God, they thought, or you gave to Caesar. Jesus said that it was not necessarily either or, but could and should be both and. We have responsibilities in the social order, what we might call the horizontal plane. We also have responsibilities to God, what we might call the vertical plane. And the two should go together. One of our responsibilities toward God is to love our neighbor. And one of our greatest services to our neighbor is the service of the truth that comes from God. Today, we've come here to St. Bernadette's not to try to trap Jesus in his speech, but to learn from him the truth that will set us free. As we ask him the same question about the allegiance we owe to the social order, to our society, to our nation, to our communities, to our city, Jesus turns and asks us something. He doesn't request to see a dollar bill or a quarter, but he rather tells us, look in the mirror. Yep. Look in the mirror and then answer me this question. Whose image do you see? He wants us to recognize that we're made in God's image and likeness. And then he turns to us and says, then give to God the things that belong to God. All that we are, all that we have, all our time, our talents, our money, our resources, our health, come from God, are part of our being in his image. And we're called by him in justice and wisdom and love to give back to God the things that are his. This was an insight Pope Francis expressed this morning as he beatified his predecessor, Pope Paul VI. He said, rendering to God the things that are God's means being docile to God's will, devoting our lives to him, and working for his kingdom of love, mercy, and peace. Paul VI truly rendered to God what is God's by devoting his entire life to the sacred, solemn, and grave task of continuing in history and extending on earth the mission of Christ. Words that Pope Paul VI preached on the Mass that started his papacy back in 1963. Loving the Church and leading her so that she might be a loving member of the whole, loving mother of the whole human family, and at the same time the minister of its salvation. Blessed Paul VI was one who gave to God the things that are God's. And because of that generosity in response to God's generosity, not only was he holy, but he did so much good in the world. Today on this World Mission Sunday, in which we pray in a special way and contribute to the missions all across the world, we can think about all those men and women, boys and girls, who are missionaries, who have rendered to God the gift of their life so that they might help others to come to discover that they too are in God's image, and that real happiness will come only when they open themselves up to receive God's gift of himself and give themselves in return out of love for God and love for others. But what I'd like to spend our time on today is what happens when conflicts arise between these two orders of responsibility, to God and to the social order. How do we resolve them? The best principle, I think, comes from the example and last words of one of the great saints in the history of civilization. Thomas More was Chancellor of England from 1529 to 1532. He was an extremely gifted man, and soon after King Henry VIII, his childhood friend, had made him second in charge of the British kingdom. He had it running on high octane. He was much respected and admired by the king, by the British people, by the church, and many throughout Europe. Eventually, however, Henry discovered that his wife, Catherine of Aragon, Spain, was incapable of bearing him a son. So he wanted to dump her and marry another who would be able to provide him an heir. And unsurprisingly, he already had someone in mind, Anne Boleyn, with whom he was cheating on his wife, the queen. Divorce was unthinkable, because he was a Christian king, and Jesus taught quite clearly that no man can separate what God had joined. So he did the only thing he could. He appealed to Pope Clement VII to look into whether his marriage to Catherine was valid. If it weren't, then the Pope could declare it null and void and he would be free to marry Anne Boleyn. After investigating, however, Pope Clement saw no reason that Henry's marriage to Catherine was invalid and said that he couldn't give him an annulment. Henry responded by declaring himself the supreme head of the church in England, dismissed Catherine, gave himself an annulment, married Anne, and then made every British subject take two oaths. One was an oath of succession, by which one would have to swear on God's holy word that the king's marriage to Catherine was null, that his marriage to Anne was valid, and that his rightful heir would be Anne's offspring. And the second oath was an oath of supremacy. One had to swear on God's holy word that the king, and not Christ through his earthly vicar, the Pope, was the head of the church on earth. What happened? Most British Catholics betrayed Jesus Christ by taking the oath. Almost every bishop in England joined them. One bishop, John Fisher, refused to take the oath and he was killed. Thomas was still chancellor, number two in the realm, but his conscience prevented him from lying before God. He consistently refused to take either of the oaths. Henry was furious and took Thomas's failure to commit as a sign of betrayal. Thomas resigned the chancellorship. His family was reduced to abject poverty, and those who had been trying to kiss up to the king sought ways to harm Thomas. Eventually, the king's loyalists trumped up charges against him to get him thrown into the Tower of London, the most infamous prison in the capital at the time. They tried to harass, molest, and starve Thomas into submission, but he never relented. Finally, they framed him and got him sentenced to death. As he stood on the platform where he would be beheaded, he was asked whether he had any last words. He did. His valedictory, right before he had his head chopped off, was to say, "I have always been the king's good servant, but God's first. I have always been the king's good servant, but God's first." Those words each of us is called to make our own. All of us are called to be good servants of our nation, of our communities, of our city. But God's good servants first. Should there ever be a conflict between what we owe to God and what our civil leaders claim we owe to them, God must win. And the greatest service we can give to our society and to our rulers is to serve God faithfully, because by this we bring them to the truth, which is the only foundation on which society can be firmly grounded. We're living in an age in which we need many more St. Thomas Mores and St. John Fishers, because it's a time where supposed conflicts between what we owe to God and what others claim we owe to society are growing. A numerically small but very litigious group of atheists, in conjunction with militant secularists on our courts, are trying to abuse the principle of the separation of church and state to eliminate any reference of God in public life or public policy. This principle of the separation of church and state comes historically from Thomas Jefferson's reflection on Jesus' principle in today's gospel of giving to Caesar and giving to God. It was enshrined in our Constitution to prevent any one religion from becoming a national religion and to prevent the national government from infringing on religious freedom. It was never intended as a means by which God could be kicked out entirely of public life. But that's precisely what the atheists and the secularists, helped by the American Civil Liberties Union, are trying to do. They want to eliminate one nation under God from the Pledge of Allegiance. They want to excise "In God We Trust" from our currency. They want to prevent creches on public policy. They want to purge prayers at graduations and sporting events. They want to remove any reference to the Ten Commandments anywhere and everywhere. Even if we're not Catholic, we can ask ourselves, as honest non-Christian public commentators have, Are we better off with God or without God in our public life? Would our society be better off if we kept the Ten Commandments or we violated the Ten Commandments? Are these atheists and seculars really helping society? Or are they saboteurs of society, destroying our society? President George Washington, who himself was not a particularly religious man, recognized that without the government supporting religion in general, the nascent United States of America would not be able to survive. He declared in his farewell address in 1796, "Of all the dispositions and habits that lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." Let it simply be asked, what's the security for prosperity, religion, and morality? What's the security for property, reputation, and life if the sense of religious obligation desert the oaths which are the instruments of investigation in courts of justice? And let us with caution indulge the supposition that morality can be maintained without religion. What was he saying? Without a deep religious sense underlying our oaths, people will lie if they can get away with it. Without a deep religious sense underlying our morality, all hell will break loose. I studied in Poland for a couple months back early in my priesthood, and there I learned a Polish aphorism that I've never been able to forget, which says that the amount of police you need on the outside is inversely proportional to the number of policemen in here. If we don't police ourselves, if we won't do something wrong, even when we can get away with it, then we'll have a free country, because our freedom won't be used to destroy ourselves, others, or our nation. But if we don't police ourselves, if we don't believe that if we tell a lie under oath, having sworn that we'll tell the whole truth, so help me God, and if we then go and lie and we don't think that God's going to hold us accountable and send us to hell, let's just lie, baby, if we can get away with it. That's what George Washington is saying. If we don't police ourselves, if we don't have a sense that there's a higher order to which we need to answer, then we're going to need cops everywhere. The second president, John Adams, had similar advice. He said, "We have no government armed with the power capable of contending with human passions, unbridled by morality and true religion. Our Constitution is made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate to the government of any other." So if our government's fighting against religion, if it's trying to banish God, we are undermining the foundation for our remaining the land of the free and the home of the brave. Yet the present occupant of the White House, in his administration, and many others who are supposedly public servants and who have sworn an oath on the Constitution, including the Bill of Rights, to defend religious freedom, are not following in the line of Washington and Adams. Instead, they're rapidly implementing a secularist agenda when it comes to the role of religion in American life. They are trampling on the rights of conscience and the right to religious freedom, trying to reduce it to freedom of worship, as if the life of faith is merely what we do here on Sunday mornings and not what we do throughout our life. But once we go down that path, we're not even safe to have freedom of worship. I'm not sure if you followed the news over the past week. Down in Houston, there's an openly lesbian mayor, Anise Parker, who has been using the coercive power of city government and the courts to try to subpoena the sermons, the speeches, the website postings of the Christian pastors in her city. Mayor Parker has been seeking to push a bathroom bill down the throats of Houston citizens and children, eliminating all same-sex bathrooms, eliminating all single-sex bathrooms so that those of confused gender can use any bathroom they want. Now, how many women here really want a whole bunch of very strong men following you into the bathroom? How many parents here want people who have already been convicted for level 4 offenses following your kids into bathrooms, especially kids of the opposite sex, following your little girls into bathrooms? That's what the mayor of Houston's trying to do. And so a handful of Christian pastors, because they recognized how wrong that was and how idiotic, sued to try to prevent that from going in. And so then Mayor Parker decides that she's going to use city government to sue all, to obtain all of their sermons, not just of the pastors who had sued, but of every pastor. There's not even freedom of worship there. And you may have heard yesterday, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, that the city government there is trying to force religious pastors to celebrate same-sex marriages. And if they don't celebrate a same-sex marriage, they'll be jailed for 6 months and have to pay a $1,000 fine every day they don't celebrate it. That's what's happening in our country. At the federal level, our federal government is seeking through the Department of Health and Human Services to force all of us against our well-informed conscience to pay for others' abortions in order to have any health care. It's forcing business owners against their consciences to pay for other people to end the lives of their babies in the womb. They're forcing nurses to participate in them, med school students to be trained in them, and pharmacists to have to prescribe chemicals, to fill prescriptions that cause them. The same administration has said it won't fund any charities that don't refer women for abortion or who discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. Meaning any Catholic institution that won't allow someone who, for example, is an out-of-the-closet practicing homosexual or transgender transvestite to be eligible for every position will no longer receive any government contracts. And they're doing that because many secularists are treating our opposition to abortion as discrimination against women. Our support for marriage as Christ made it, discrimination against gays. Our support of the truth as imposing our version of morality on them as they continue to ram a secularist agenda down our throats. Today, our diocese is having its annual Red Mass, calling down the power of the Holy Spirit on those who work in the legal profession as lawyers, judges, and court personnel. I'm very happy that Claudine Cloutier of our parish, one of our catechists and finance council members, is to be awarded the St. Thomas More Award as a distinguished lawyer by Bishop de Cunha. These Red Masses become more important over the years as the legal profession has been getting used as an instrument against religious freedom and against religion and morality in our society, which are indispensable supports, as Washington said, for our survival. A few years ago, Bishop Thomas Paprocki of Springfield, Illinois, a civil lawyer by training, went to Houston to give the homily at their Red Mass. After reviewing some of the same incursions against religious freedom that I just detailed, he said, "Perhaps the best antidote to profane secularism can be learned from the example of those who withstood and defeated godless communism. One of the staunchest defenders of the church in communist Poland was the primate of Poland, Cardinal Stefan Wyszyński. In May 1953, the communist regime ordered the implementation of a law by which it, not the Catholic Church, would appoint and remove pastors, vicars, and bishops. The church would become de facto a subsidiary of the state. In a powerful sermon in Warsaw, St. John's Cathedral, Cardinal Wyszyński drew the line saying, We teach that it's proper to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. But when Caesar sits himself on the altar, we respond curtly, he may not. As free citizens, are we going to draw the line? What's it going to take? We need to do more as free citizens than respond curtly that the government can't do it when it's squatting on our altars, when it's subpoenaing our sermons, when it's trying to force people to become agents of the state and do things that we believe are wrong. But we just can't give lip service here. We need to act. Question is whether we will. Are we going to be like Catholics in 16th century Britain, most of whom did nothing in response to the tyranny of Henry VIII? Will we just go along with the tide as they did, provided that we're left alone for now? Or will we stand up like St. John Fisher and St. Thomas More and say, we are good American citizens, but citizens of heaven first? Are we God's servant above all or not? And are we willing to show it? The big question we need to answer as Americans is whether we're going to continue to take these outrages and behave like the vast majority of Catholic lay people and clergy in the 1500s who did nothing when God's rights were being trampled upon except side with those who were doing the trampling, or whether we're going to rise up peacefully as the modern St. Thomas More's and St. John Fisher's or in Cardinal Wyszynski's. We ultimately reap what we sow, and we are the people who have been electing the people who have been doing this, and electing the people who have been appointing the judges who have been doing this. When's that going to stop? Today, God asks us to look in the mirror and to see in whose image we've been made. Then he calls us to act in accordance with that dignity. Through the intercession of Blessed Paul VI, who gave his life in service to God and to the truths of the faith. Through the intercession of St. John Fisher and St. Thomas More. May God give us the help he knows we need, so that we may always render to God the things that are his, and be able to say at every moment of our life and at the moment of our death that we have always been citizens of our great land, but God's good and faithful servants first. This is our Christian calling, to render to God the things that are God's. God's about to strengthen us by the Holy Eucharist so that we may do it. Let's act.